Good morning, everybody, and welcome to Room 42. I'm Liz Fraley from Single Sourcing Solutions. I'm your moderator. This is Janice Summers, our interviewer, and welcome to Saul Carliner, today's guest in Room 42. Saul is a professor of educational technology at Concordia University in Montreal. His teaching and research focus is on the design of instructional and informational materials, especially in emerging media, the management of groups that produce those materials, and related issues of policy and professionalism. He's got more publications than I can count on half a dozen people. His upcoming book, Career Anxiety, Guidance for Tough Times, it was with Margaret Driscoll and Yvonne Thayer, and that's coming out very soon. He has a best-selling book, Training Design Basics. He's award-winning writing of Informal Learning Basics. He's a fellow, a past board member of the Institute of Performance and Learning of the STC. He's a research fellow at the Association for Talent Development. I mean, he serves industry as a consultant. He's been a teacher and a sharer of information for his entire career. And we are super grateful he's here to help us start answering the question, what does the future hold for careers in professional and technical writing? Welcome.
Howdy. Hi.
So we are so thrilled to have you here. I mean, absolutely delighted to have a conversation. And I think the topic that you're bringing to the table in this book is so important. And it's really very interesting. Your target market in this is actually towards people who are in the middle of their career, which I find absolutely fascinating because most people don't target that.
No, they don't.
Well, it was interesting. We started working on this book. It was not going to be it was going to be something completely, utterly different. Uh-huh. And it morphed over time. We wanted to look at the original plan was to look at training and development, which is the field that Margaret and I have published many books on.
Right.
And we wanted to get the original plan was to write something academic that was going to be a little bit more focused on some miscalculations some misassumptions about the way people work mm-hmm. in the field and mm-hmm. how that ultimately leads to flaws in theory. And we may still actually work on that book. But one of the things that was happening at the same time, that was about the time they started publishing some of the original studies on the impact of automation and AI on work, and they were talking about these, like, up to 40% of all jobs are going to be destroyed, and there are going to be these new jobs, but nobody knew what they were, and everybody just said, and training is going to be the solution. And we'd say, all right, what are you going to train them on? And what's this training going to do? And there's like zilch, nothing, nada on mm-hmm. that. They just basically, and it's typical people, you know, it's in tough times, people always throw a lot of money at training, which is great, but you know, then people go through the training and they don't get a job because it was the wrong training or they didn't really. I mean, it's a feel good measure to say, I'm going to pay you to train. Mm-hmm. But the thing is that some of the new jobs we could anticipate were going to be at a very different skill level from the ones they replaced. And we were mm-hmm. seeing this gross bifurcation of the workplace where you've got increasingly high skilled and high paying and low skilled and low paying jobs. And there's the middle's being hollowed out, just like you see almost in every other place. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, okay, so what if you're one of those people? What happens to you? And most of the career guides like follow your passion. And the only person who says something different is Mike Rowe, who does that TV show. I think it's kind of interesting. He's also originally from Baltimore. And maybe Baltimore makes us skeptics about the job market but all the other books say looking at they're finding your passion or finding your first job or finding your first real job because the other ones really didn't count. And we began with, well, by the time even you're doing, let's say you're looking for your real job when you're 30, at the very least you have some kind of debt. You might have kids, you might have alimony or, you know, family, you may have elderly parents to support and just have fun with all of that. Or what happens, and I've lived in small cities within the US, what happens when one of your major employers just decides to ditch town?
Right, to pack
and
up.
You've got kids like in the end of high school, you can't. So what are you supposed to do? And that's when we brought in our third co-author, Yvonne, who's actually worked little bit more in some of these things. And we started digging down deep and then started also saying, all right, so what does this mean? And how do people, we can't give direct advice because everybody's particular situation is unique, but how do we steer people in a direction that's productive? And so that's how we came up with the book.
Yeah. And I like the fact that you were saying it's, you know, it's not a matter of following your passion. Cause when you get to a certain age, it's like, you know, you're lucky if you're in your interest, right?
Well, something I think sometimes we saw, I mean, it's, I watch way too much TV and I always think it's interesting whenever they have kids, they're always going to be musicians and actors. And it's like, I get where they're coming from, but the reality is that that's not what most people are going to do. And you are having a really good life if you do something else, and you can develop a passion for what you do, even if it isn't what you dreamed of doing. You know, I wanted to be a writer. I am a writer. I didn't realize that I'm much better suited for nonfiction writing than fiction writing until I started being a tech writer. And then from there, just telling, you know, you get to tell everybody what to do. I mean, what's more powerful than that, you know?
Right.
Except for training and really
you
down
have
to what
listen
to do.
To me.
You don't get to do that in, you know, fiction. So
it's and a lot of things you don't. And it's funny that you draw that conclusion because it's true. You get to be the boss of her. You get to tell everybody what to do.
Oh yeah.
Right. And the field of technical writing, a lot of times people trip into this field. Like it wasn't that, you know, a certain generation in this field that like tripped into it.
It's a second career.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I apologize for interrupting.
No, that's okay.
It's a second career. Like when we did the census of tech communicators and we looked at almost a really good percentage had a previous career. And for whatever reason, this is the one that they, you know, it's kind of like a second marriage. Okay. That's fine. But I think it's interesting because training is many ways the same thing. And I have this friend who's convinced we're going to teach all these people, go to high schools and recruit. It's like, you're going to a 16-year-old and saying, you want a career training your parents' friends. Ew. You know, I mean, when your contemporaries, it's a different story, but when it's your parents' friends, I mean, come on. That doesn't, and he has kids. I don't. I mean, but even I know that.
That's funny. So the book is applicable to any field, right?
It's not limited to tech writing. I have a few tech writing examples in there and training examples, but we have tons of other examples. And we talk about, and we actually address the pandemic. I mean, we were pretty close to finishing and then this little experience had happened, but it's typical. I mean, one of the things that a concept that I learned a few years ago was something called VUCA. It's not new. It just happened to be new to me. And it's basically, it's just saying we live in a really fast moving world with a lot of uncertainty in it. And there's only so much we can control that. And so the pandemic is just a perfect example of how we're truly in a VUCA world.
Yeah. And I think that lends itself well to how you've structured this book. I really like the organization of it because you're giving guidance and asking questions, not solving problems.
I have one co-author who's like adamant. We don't tell people what to do. I said, but we do kind of point them in the direction. Let's be honest. It's been a labor of love. We meet like weekly. It's been with Margaret and I, we've been meeting on this project for, I think it's 7 years. And Yvonne joined us. It was funny because we were horrified, but we realized it's been 5 years. We finally have a book to show for it. We think we'll have it by the beginning of June. We're in final copy edits for the print proofs, but we'll produce the Kindle version and then we'll launch both on the same day. But the organization, actually, there's a logic to it. And we spent a lot of time as a team just discussing and working through that. Mm-hmm. And the idea was there are things going on in the world that are changing what work looks like. And what work looked like for my parents, and certainly when I started my career, is very different than what it looks like now. And it has a lot, is rooted in what happened in the 1980s in the economy. What's another piece that's really uncertain? Are we undoing the work of the 1980s right now in bigger society? I don't know the answer to that. Some people say we're definitely doing it. I think it's an unanswered question and will remain unanswered probably through the decade. But there are different priorities for business. And as a result, they're making different kinds of commitments to people. Mm-hmm. And that changes one nature of jobs. There's also the incentives changed for for-profit companies, and to a large extent, even government agencies and not-for-profits. And as a result, that changed how they viewed labor and working. And so we wanted to talk about that because that affects not just jobs themselves, but where the jobs are and how people get employed. And we have a fair amount of discussion of the contingent employment arrangement because it's a more common mm-hmm. one. And we want people to be prepared for that if that's what ends up being the right choice for them. Mm-hmm. Then we go into particulars. How do you prepare to be qualified for a job? How do you get the job? Because the job search has become increasingly automated. And most of us are familiar with the automation that goes with the submission side. What people don't realize is just how much automation goes on the other side after people receive those applications and how they process those.
And that's a kind of a necessary evil. Now, do you go into a lot of navigation? Because there's a lot of artificial intelligence now that's being brought into the recruitment process.
Even into the interviewing, it was kind of fascinating because Margaret wrote that chapter and then I was editing it. And then about 6 months later, I had students actually went through this automated interview where you actually, I know that there's a human being at the other side of this. They just have a little pop-up question. It's the camera's on, but that's the extent of the interaction. You get a couple of takes and decide which one you want to keep. And then some AI is actually going to analyze the body motion and the voice and all that. That's kind of scary.
It is scary. Really, and I can't wait when the book comes out. I can't wait to read that particular chapter.
Yeah.
I'm really keen on that.
We had Huiling Ding from NC State talking about that too, because she's also looking at that, like the automation of that. It's very
impersonal. But we want people to know that. By the way, that's for jobs that are considered pedestrian. For the other jobs that are considered like high value, and that's going to be defined differently by each employer. Let's say call it concierge service. And in fact, in that chapter, we talk about that side of it too. And then we talk about, okay, now you got the job. What happens? Because you sign a lot of agreements on day one, and some of them may or may not actually be in your own best interest. But you don't really have a choice you have a choice, but your choice is to say no. And they probably will say, well, thank you anyway. Mm-hmm. And they have the right to do that. And then finally, how do you maintain your skills? Because I think I've done other research. And one of the things that's always worried me is that increasingly people recognize that they are responsible for their own long-term development and that their careers are their own. That's good. The problem is that there's one thing to say it, another thing to actually do something about it. And they're not investing much time and they're not investing much money, if any. And I'm surprised by how significant the population that invests nothing, either in time or money or both. It's pretty high. Probably a third.
Yeah. And I think that everyone needs to understand, if you have a career, any career, it doesn't matter. There's a cost of ownership of that career. And that cost of ownership is owned by you.
Exactly. Right?
And when you get a job, they're giving you some remuneration towards that, right? But you really
In theory, but over and above that, and employers are investing in training.
Yes.
I've done some other studies. It's not to the extent that it used to be. And it goes down and it doesn't really keep up with inflation. So, it's not to be negative, but it's just saying if you really value your career, you will invest money in it. I will say that I did that through my entire career before, I'd even studied this stuff. I just, this is what I want, I wanted a credential or whatever. I went after it. I didn't let whether my employer was going to pay for it or not get in the way. But a lot of other people say, my employer won't pay. Well, they might not pay. The question is, do you want it? Because if you want it, then you need to go get it.
Right. Well, and you need to understand your employer today might not be your employer tomorrow.
That's the other thing. But
by choice or by happenstance.
But the other, it was funny because when I started my career at IBM, and someone said, you need to be nice to everyone because you never know when they're going to be your manager. And what's really interesting is even though the idea of a lifelong career in a single company is basically kaput, the idea that you're going to keep running into the same people over and over again is definitely alive, well, and it really behooves people to not burn their bridges. And that we'd actually discuss that in the book too. And as well as how to vent privately in a way that will allow you to feel like, I got this off my chest, but not in such a way it's like, and I ruined my career in the process.
Right. Which is important because we all get frustrated.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's human nature. You don't want to get frustrated in the wrong way and vent the wrong direction. I think it's really interesting because I think in the book you cover a lot of areas that it's kind of like a career and life, right? Because we are, we live our careers too. So it's interesting. You have a whole chapter on finance. You have a whole area.
Yeah. Because absolutely. You know, that was something that came in early, and my co-author Yvonne worked, you know, prepared the first draft. We all contribute to what goes into each chapter, but each one of us, obviously we did a little divide and conquer there. Mm-hmm. Yvonne just like went to town with it, but she lives in a small town in Virginia. Mm-hmm. And so there's some really cool opportunities there, but there are some limits on those opportunities precisely because of the size of the community. Mm-hmm. And so she's really attuned to some of those issues. But the other thing that she's really attuned to is student debt and how that can live with you for the rest of your life if you don't manage it. Mm-hmm. And we see people, not only they have a ton of student debt, but then they decide I need to take on more student debt because my first round of student debt didn't get me the job I wanted. Well, at some point, you know, unlike other types of debt, you can't bankrupt your way out of this. In fact, I did some work with the Canada Student Loan Program up here, and I was talking with some Americans who worked on one of the American programs, and the economist said, oh, they have so many ways of finding you. You can even declare yourself dead. If you're not dead, they will find you. And they were only partially exaggerating. Student debt is one of the few types of debt you can never, never run away from. That's why we really want to caution people about getting into it. But that's not the only financial issue that you need to think about. Salaries are different depending on where you live, but so is the cost of living. Opportunity, good in some places, but the cost is there's a higher cost of living. So you'll be able to have a really rich career in a place and be able to job hop a bit, but you may have, it's going to cost you. I mean, and these are trade-offs that people need to make. The other thing is if you've got elderly parents or kids in late high school, are you really going to uproot yourself at that point? Yeah. Or what if you've got a spouse? It's not as simple as like, we'll commute like, you know, halfway across the country. That's not cheap either. So we want people to, you know, we can't tell you everything, but at least we can start getting into your head. When you choose a job, it's not just what you're doing. The compensation and the full benefits, that's the other thing we talk about, are part of that package. And you need to think about that as well as where you work, because that's going to turn, you know, God forbid your job gets automated out of existence or your employer goes under or whatever. Are you going to be able to find another job in the same community? One of the things they found out after the 2008 downturn, used to be Americans were really quite mobile. We would move all over the place. I mean, I moved countries. But after 2008, some people had just moved. They were stuck with these houses that were no longer worth what they were supposed to be worth.
Yeah.
And they were like an island because their support systems were someplace else and they lost their job. And so when it came to moving again, some people were saying, I'm not sure I'm willing to take that risk because it could be a much bigger risk than I realized in the past.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people ended up underwater and isolated, trying to tread to keep alive.
Exactly.
But I think one of the things that that your book is helping to promote too for people is that strategic thinking and that pre-planning and thinking of yourself like Myself Inc. And thinking a couple of stages ahead, right?
Yeah.
And looking at contingency factors and looking at cascading effects and thinking of these things strategic, especially when you're at, you know, the age group that this is really targeted for, people who are already in a career.
Yeah. And transitioning from one career to another, we want people to recognize it may be essential because your career just kind of died. For example, I anticipate that truck drivers will become obsolete for the most part when automated, you know, trucks start hitting the road. There will be a replacement career of people who are like truck traffic controllers, but that's not the same skill at all.
Right. So that would be like a situation where they have to think ahead and then plan now and morph to that, right?
Totally, totally.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that they can start, you know, getting the knowledge that they need for that.
Yeah, and also thinking, do I want to stay in that career? Do I want to try something else? I mean, if you're going to have to go back to the start, where do you want to be?
Or what skills do you have now that you've built? Because you've established, you know, by the time you're 40, you've established a hefty amount of time in developing skill sets. Right?
Yeah, no, and what skills can you leverage? And how can you do that in a positive way? You know, it's interesting to hear somebody reflect back a book because it's just been the three of us. And we have our, you know, at this point, we have our script after like 5 years of working on it. And you're bringing up some things that, you know, to be honest, they're part of our thinking, but they really, I hadn't thought about them. So the strategic thinking or the career stuff, I usually think about it in a really negative sense. It's like, what, because one of the things that happens also as you get older, you also, there are things that you, how do I put this? That make us difficult to work with. And every one of us has something like that.
Yes.
And they become barriers. And for some people, they're insurmountable barriers unless they do some really hard work on themselves. Mm-hmm. And for other people, it's just something that you need to be aware of and find some compensating factor, some compensating method.
Check yourself, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you have to be brutally honest with yourself. It's like, me and deadlines are not exactly the best. This is my personal one. Me and deadlines are not really good friends.
Me neither.
And I have to be honest. I'm awful with deadlines. I mean, I do appointments really, really well, which is great as a teacher and an instructor or as an administrator. But when I have to write and there's a deadline, oh my God. I mean, getting that thing out of me, I think it's easier, you know, opening up a safe that's like completely secure.
I run the other way. Like you tell me there's a deadline. I go completely the opposite way. I go do something completely not related. It's like a protest.
I'm the same way.
I threw a little temper tantrum.
I think I watch the most TV when I'm supposed to be doing something else. There's so many shows you can watch. You know, like, and by the way, if you're really lucky, there's a Law and Order marathon somewhere. And even if you've watched them seven times, I always forget the ending. It's always kind of fun to watch them again.
Well, you know, and there's the whole UK jury and there's some really
there's the obscure Law and Orders UK. There's the reality one. There's the Los Angeles that lasted all 6 months. That one lasts a whole year, excuse me. Trial by jury and a few other ones, you know.
So we can always find distractions and ways for us not to hit a deadline.
Yeah, but to be honest, SVU and the mothership, like they do the job.
Yeah. But I think you bring up a really good point because when we do get to a certain seniority in our career or a certain, you know, age, we're a little bit more, we've been there, done that. So we have a little bit more resistance because of life lessons. But I think that's where, you know, we just need to remind ourselves that
we do.
To think fresh and new and to push ourselves a little bit more. And know our weaknesses. I think that's important. Is like if you know your knee-jerk reaction to a deadline is resistance, expect it. You know, demonstrating it to others, let them know.
I think the thing too about experience, and this is something we bring out in the book. It used to be you were paid for years of experience. That's no longer. It's what that experience really is. I mean, you can be spending 15 years acquiring a really nice, broad base of experience, so you have 15 years doing the same thing over and over again.
Right.
If it's the latter, you're probably not going to be as valued as the former. Other thing that we have, and this is the last chapter, is there things that the other thing that comes with age is that we increasingly face discrimination based solely on the fact that we have hair color that's not exact. Either it's not naturally not gray or it is gray. And regardless of which one of those cases it is, people just look at it and they just say, oh, I don't want to hire that old person. And what can you do about that? My basic belief is, there's nothing you can do about it. And there will be some employers that are just absolutely convinced that the only person that can help them is a young person. And if they want to be that way, you know, you could talk to your blue in the face, you're not going to change their mind. But I do know that there's such a shortage of young people these days. Universities and colleges are going bankrupt, and it's because there's a shortage of young people. And when people get really desperate, the biggest source of new workers is another reason why we looked at this book. The biggest source of new workers are the workers who are already here. Mm-hmm. And most of us are going to be working until we're way old because we spend our money a lot. So, and we're going to be working into our late 60s and 70s. And there are people working into their 80s, and not because, oh, I just love my career. It's because I need to meet the bills.
Mm-hmm.
And
we like that, the benefits and the revenue, the continuous
they revenue. Need the revenue.
It's a nice thing to have. And we're living longer.
But you got to, people are living longer, and there are some, it's a touchy political issue, but governments are actually want people to work longer because it means you don't have to pay things like Social Security or what we call social insurance quite as early. Mm-hmm. And some people actually, they retire and they're so bored, they're not necessarily looking to work full time, but they do want something more stimulating, and they want to work in their old line of work. And like I said, if that's the supply, some employers are starting to recognize, you know what? These people aren't exactly washed up and out, that, over the hill. They may have some hill left to climb.
Right. I think one of the things, I think it's going to be like the new recruitment frontier is to recruit people that are 60 plus, because there's a little difference, right? We tend to, if there's a task that needs to get done, we tend to want to just get the job done.
Yeah.
Right.
Exactly. And
so there's a difference in the demographics of that age group that will become quite attractive to people.
And we show up to work more.
What's that?
We're more efficient, and we show up to work more. Believe it or not.
Yeah. Yeah. We're less apt to go out to the, to the clubs and go clubbing the night before.
Oh yeah.
I'd say meet our deadlines, but we both had two of you say, I don't like deadlines.
No, but that's okay, because we can change our knowing that you don't like something.
That's right.
You can compensate for it. You can adjust.
Yeah, I think you can compensate.
Yeah. That's just a part of knowing yourself. And I think that's the other thing, when you get a little older, you kind of know yourself, or you should.
Well, it's interesting. Like there are certain assignments I get asked to do, like do design and development jobs, which I would love to do. But I say, look, I'm going to be really honest with you. You'll be dead before you ever get anything out of me. So I'm not even going to entertain the contract. There was someone who was after me for 3 years. It was like, I don't think you understand. You do not want me. You will not have a product.
Right.
And I referred to them and said, they're really good with their deadlines, and they're actually good with the stuff they do.
Yeah.
You're going to like them better than you ever would have liked me.
See, that's the other advantage of having, people who are a little longer in their career, because they know people, especially if they're engaged in their career. And I think that's one of the nice things that your book really promotes, is being engaged in your career.
Oh, yeah. We also talk about the importance of networking. It's really important to do that.
It is.
So we all know people. Like, I can throw Liz any scenario and she's like, oh, this person, that person. She's like, connects worlds. Like, it's fascinating. Right? And those things become, really critical.
Oh, yeah.
And I think very advantageous. There was another point that you had brought up earlier, and I wanted to circle back to it, and I forgot. Oh.
I thought I was the only one that had that problem.
What's that?
I thought I was the only one that had that problem.
No, I get really excited talking with you, Saul, because then I go running down it's like we're like galloping through the forest. We go running down a path. And I forgot this little divergence I wanted to take.
Well, I can take you divergently. I'm surprised how much on topic I'm being today. So,
last
conversation was way not on topic.
Oh, really? Oh, well, we try to keep it at least close to the topic, that people have signed on to listen to and engage in, because it's an interesting topic. So, the book,
and it's top of mind right now.
Yeah.
Well, I do know that even here in Silicon Valley, there have been a lot of changeover and a lot of people out of work the last year or so, especially in tech comm.
Yeah.
So it's very current.
Well, it's funny because, I didn't think about this as much as I should have when I was writing the book. But one of the things that drove us was people being automated out of work, and tech, the whole field of communications is so, we're probably one of, if not the most affected fields in terms of this. So, in tech comm alone, we used to have these huge production departments. I remember when I started my first job and I was using word processing. I learned to use word processing my last term in university, and it was a tag-based word processor, kind of like HTML. Mm-hmm. And I'm really glad that's how I learned as opposed to the WYSIWYG. Anyway, but my handwriting, to say it sucks is really too nice. I wrote a check once to my mother and she goes, "You call that a signature? They're not going to." I said, "Take it to the bank. If they don't honor it, then we'll figure another way to get the money to you." But but that's how bad my handwriting is. And so I was typing and she says, "Well, we have secretaries to do that." Well, they were gone within a couple of years. And then over time,
yeah,
the editors went. I mean, the people who were full-time editors, because you had so much of that job had been automated with, like, you know, Grammatique and then Grammarly. You've got all these programs that do that. We had these huge, when desktop publishing first came out, there was a whole new career integrated into the job of the tech writer. So that's one of the reasons why we've had some adjustments in size in STC, because we've seen this growth and then, you know, then there was a contraction. And we've had it better than some other fields, because you look at what's happened in, you know, the mainstream media, where they've been devastated by Google Ads and Facebook Ads, which was completely killed their classified ads. And that was their primary source of income. And so people's like, it's the subscriptions. Subscriptions were just, that was found money for them. Now they're actually quite important in the digital world, because advertising is a lot less expensive. Mainstream television has been completely disrupted by first cable and then by streaming. And what I find really interesting is they say they're disrupted. They spend a lot less for the shows and they use the same show. You can watch the same broadcast on like five different feeds at the same time, which mm-hmm. makes me wonder where, I mean, you've got to be saving money. So where, like, why is this such a great development? Because I'm getting the same, you know, 500 channels and only three things on. I had that when I only had three and I didn't have to pay a monthly fee for it. I just, mm-hmm. you know, had to move the antennas every so often. So, okay, I'm dating myself. But yeah, but we've been automated extensively. And there's some, the one that scares me, I was hearing years ago that, you know, from the minutes of like a city council meeting, you can write local news for a lot of stuff. And you just basically, they can have a bot do that. You don't even need, or at the least, you can have someone in the Philippines writing about, you know, the local city council meeting in, you know, some small city in California, small city in Minnesota and Georgia. And
so with all of that, though, with all of those changes, are there things that have been timeless that are timeless? These sets of skills are timeless. And if you hone these sets of skills,
well, someone has to do the
no amount of automation. That what's that?
Someone has to do the templates and train the AI. So there's going to be work for that. it's going to sound really, really selfish, but Bloomberg had this little chart. I guess now they put it behind their paywall, but it was for free for a while, where you could like move it around and see what the likelihood of your profession of being automated out of existence was. And judges, it was a 40% chance of being automated, because a lot of a lot of sentences are really want to be fair, and a lot of them to be, I mean, you want to judge the circumstance, but a lot of cases it's a little bit more black and white than that. So they can do a lot of that, you know, by automation, but teaching isn't. And especially when you're doing training, because when you're teaching K through 12, they've got, even with population decline in that age group, you still have millions and millions of kids in any given year. And so you have the numbers to do AI and do automated tutoring and all that. When you talk about a training program, it's proprietary to the company. You may have 50 to 100 people that need to be trained. You need a minimum of 100 just to train the AI, and usually need another 100 to make sure it's really working. Well, you don't even have the 200 to train the AI. So it's probably just cheaper to let a human do it. It's like, if nothing else, I'm pretty much guaranteed a job because I can always train. So, and I train the trainers right now. So I feel pretty decent. And our numbers in my particular program have been really, really good for the coming year.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating. I think I kind of remember, but it's hard to remember exactly what we were talking about at the time, but it was something around skill sets.
Yeah.
Versus job titles. Like, Yeah. It's like, it's the meat of what you do is more important than the title that you carry, because we're talking about employers. Yeah. That's what I wanted to ask you about. Is that a fair statement? Like, because I think that there's certain careers where they just have a generic title and everyone in that career has that title, but the importance is the skill set. And as a former recruiter, I'll tell you, it was the skill set I was looking at, not the title. I could care less about the title. You call yourself, really, your job title is Bob. It doesn't matter. Yeah. What is the skill?
Well, it's kind of like naming the field. On the one hand, it's like, it's who you are. I mean, and some people are their job title. And so it's integrated very, you know, it's knitted into their identity. And if you give them a job title that doesn't make them proud, that's going to be a real blow to the ego. So I think we need to look at that piece of it. Mm-hmm. But then there's the other piece. So you can have a really great job title, but it doesn't mean you're doing anything worthwhile. Right. And reality, with the move towards behavioral interviewing and with the question being, how would you handle, as opposed to what is the responsibility, the larger your base of experience, who cares what the job title is, you're going to be in a better position to answer that question because you've got something to draw on from that base of experience. Mm-hmm. And that's, in the end, like I said, it's the years of experience are no longer important. The other thing is that organizations are a lot flatter now. Even the ones that are big are a lot flatter. Yes. So there just aren't as many levels to go through. So there just aren't that many really cool job titles to get.
Right.
So, and, yeah, it's what you do ultimately is more important than what you are called. And I find that, you know, you can say that until you're blue in the face, and people will, on an intellectual level, will understand that. But on a personal level, there's a certain self-identification with your job title. And so it may be harder to separate yourself from that on an emotional level than it is on the intellectual level.
Well, and I think for some industries, it's more difficult than others, because there are other industries where it's like, yeah, whatever, this title, they don't really care. They don't care if you're called the CEO. It's just, it's built in, like, specifically with software engineers, they really do have, you know, member of technical staff. Working on?
Whatever.
Some
people, like, I've had like former students that come to me, it's like they're really obsessed with the job title. In some cases, if it has to do with the responsibilities that go with it, I think it's important. The other case, like that, remember one time I was on an unrelated board to TechCom, but our executive director wanted to get a new title of CEO. And she was like, this will give me much more importance. I said, well, you know, the research actually doesn't support that, but if it makes you feel better, I don't have a problem with it. Right. But it's like, it's not going to, and I think that's what people think. This job title is going to give me, no. In her case, she commanded respect by just walking in the room. That's the kind of person she was. So she could have the job title of janitor. It didn't matter. She would walk in there and people would respect her. And I think that's what people don't really get. It's that job title,
I agree,
it needs to be descriptive enough so that someone understands it. In my other field of training, people say, oh, everyone hates to be called a trainer that's in training. And what I find hilarious about that is when you go outside the field of training, and I've done this, you use any other term, nobody knows what you're talking about. When you say I'm doing training, I just gave up. It's like, I'm a trainer. I'm not ashamed.
You're like, I get it now.
I actually wrote a piece that I've never submitted, but my co-author thought it was called Internalized Trainophobia. And I started off with like all these lines in there that you would say, I'm gay. And I was just talking about like all these things people say awful about. It's like, okay. And she's right. You can't say that. It's like, you need to read to the fifth paragraph. I can say that. I said, you would never say this about somebody who is gay. So why would you say this about yourself because you're a trainer? It's just as awful. You need to go to a therapist and have to deal with this fact that you don't like your job title. You're doing an important thing, but you also got to keep that importance in check. You know, it's 1-2% of the company's payroll, not even their total expenses. You are not the most important thing on the face of the earth.
And it's, oh my God, I want to read that.
What you do is important because you get people going in their jobs. That's great.
Right?
But once they're going, they're gone. And someone else needs you. And that's great.
Right.
And they appreciate you. And you're doing an important job for society. But the fact that you're not at the CEO's table, you're not a CEO, you're not a C-suite person. And there's nothing wrong with that. You should sneak in after the meeting because the food's pretty good. So, I mean, that's really, I have really strong feelings about this because I was reading stuff from 50 years ago in training. And it's like, we need to get a seat in the table. Well, they're still saying that 50 years later. Maybe you need to come to the conclusion, if it hasn't happened in a half a century, it ain't going to happen. Maybe
and do you really,
them, it's you.
Right. And do you really need a seat at that table?
No, in fact, I really? Met with one client and they were actually, they had everything that you wanted. They were in early and they actually said, I'm not sure why we're there. They're not sure why we're there. There are certain decisions they have to make before we can do anything meaningful with them. And they hadn't made them yet. And we don't have the expertise or the interest in making those decisions for them.
Right.
Right. Right. Wow. And we are right on the timer. Oh my God. Like it just breezed. It just breezed by.
Oh my gosh.
I always have fun. I just enjoy talking to you all so much. It's always a lovely adventure.
Yeah, exactly.
It's
a beautiful feeling.
All right. So the book is out in June.
Yes.
And you have a big article coming out.
Yeah, the next issue of Intercom, just real quick. It's a study that we did in conjunction with STC on what do the technical professionals who pay our salaries think of us? And things of like, you know, rating what we do, their best and worst experiences. And then are we, you know, basically, are we valuable? And then some tips on things that we should be paying attention to manage perceptions of our individual work as well as our career and our field.
Very cool. And that comes out.
I'm hoping in the next month. I've read proofs, so I think they're pretty close. They haven't given me anything yet, but it was supposed to be a little bit earlier, but I think we're pretty close.
Yeah, I got a little sneak peek at a bit of it, and I highly recommend everybody get a hold of it, as well as the book when it comes out in June. These are things you definitely want to have, and you want to integrate into your state of being. Meditate on them, because they're really important. These are tools of strength and empowerment, so that you are in control and you can take control. And it's just a matter of decisions that you make. You are responsible. So I love it. I love it all, Saul.
I do too.
I love it all. Yeah. Yeah. Fantastic. So I hope to have you back.
I hope to come back. Thanks.
It's just been such a privilege having you here.
Oh, it's mine.